pleasure to welcome you all at the third meeting of the Associates of the National Institute of Advanced Studies. And it's very pleasing to see that a large number of people have come to listen to Professor M.N. Srinivas today. Professor M.N. Srinivas, as is usually said, doesn't need any introduction, but it's always a graceful gesture to introduce a formidable scholar of his repute with at least some words which show our respect to him, and I intend doing that. Professor M.N. Srinivas is at the moment the J.R.D. Tata visiting professor to the National Institute of Advanced Studies. He's also the chairman of the Institute of Socioeconomic Change. A foremost sociologist of this country, and who has trained a number of students who have themselves gone on to head very, very important distinguished departments. Professor Srinivas is not only a sociologist, but as I usually refer to him when I am with him, he is a social astrologer almost. He has predicted things which have come true for the country. A socio-historian, if you may like to call. The things he said in his essays on caste, what he has said in his book called Remember Village, has come out to be very true for our country, as you all would know. More recently, he has written a very important book of essays, collected essays, Living Through Revolution. He had written the first chapter of this book, Living Through Revolution, about 6 years, 7 years ago, and he had predicted in that there is going to be violence and bloodshed in this country, and unfortunately that also has come to be true. Though this is unpleasant, the fact that these kind of predictions might help us to sort of do something to change the situation in the country is something we should keep in our mind. I don't want to go through the series of awards which Professor Srinivas has had during his distinguished career, but a couple of awards need mention: Padma Bhushan, given by the Government of India, and the Fellowship of the British Academy, which is a very distinguished honor. You are also familiar that at one time, and this is an anecdote which everybody mentions about Professor Srinivas, how he had lost his collected data, hard collected data, in a fire, and then he sat down and rewrote from his memory what he had collected, and that came out as the book Remembered Village. Professor Srinivas has something new to tell us today, and he's going to tell us through his talk on changing values in Indian society. Professor Srinivas.
Dr. Raja Ramana, Dr. Kapoor, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I don't want to burden a rather longish lecture with an introduction, but I'd like to apologize for its length. I would have liked to cut it by about 5 to 10 minutes, but my excuse is, and it's I think it's a good one, that I have to cover a good deal of ground, and even then I feel that I haven't covered some areas. It's a talk intended for educated laymen and not for professional sociologists and anthropologists. When I gave an early version of it, very early version of it, in Bangalore about 6 months ago, a few members of the audience wanted me to publish it at once, but it was too raw, too unfinished, and I spent 2 to 3 months revising and rewriting the lecture, and here is the result. I must caution you that many of the facts which I have narrated here in this talk are known to most of you, and you might well wonder, why is it that I am wasting your time narrating them? But it is my feeling, I may be wrong, that when they are put together, they seem to form a pattern and indicate a trend. But of that, you will be a better judge than I at the end of this lecture. Before I proceed further, I would like to provide a brief and tentative idea of what I mean by values. I have in mind those ideals of conduct, the practice of which is admired by a people. Implicit in such admiration is a recognition that the ideals are difficult to practice, and those who succeed in practicing them are regarded as exceptional individuals and providing models for others to emulate. However, my aim here is not so much to provide a satisfactory definition of values, that I leave to philosophers, but only to convey a rough and ready idea of what I mean, so that I can proceed with my main task, which is to discuss the changes in ideals of conduct, that is values, which have taken place and are taking place in India today. Values are a difficult subject to discuss with respect to any people, but the difficulty increases enormously when dealing with a country as vast, diverse, stratified, and complex as India. Values vary from one section of the people to another on the basis of region, language, religion, sect, caste, class, and ethnicity. There are also significant differences between villagers and city dwellers. Indeed, the complexity is so great that one is tempted to abandon the task as hopeless. But then, valor is sometimes, though very rarely, is better than discretion. In this connection, while one cannot but be skeptical of the glib establishment phrase, unity in diversity, one cannot also give up looking for commonalities underlying diversity, and one cannot rule out the possibility of finding commonalities in the most unlikely of places. But that task does not concern me here. Values ought to be distinguished from norms governing actual behavior. For instance, monogamy is a value for men and women in certain sections of Indian society. And this has to be distinguished from norms which govern the behavior of husbands and wives. Thus, a husband in a traditional marriage is expected to provide for his wife and children, while the wife has to cook and serve food and perform other domestic chores. She is also expected to obey her husband, who has the right to chastise her when he thinks that her conduct is not wifely. But the norms are not very clear when two educated members of the middle classes get married and both of them are earning. Even at the level of norms, there is a distinction between what may be called statistical norms and ideal norms. The norm may be mutual sexual fidelity on the part of husband and wife. However, local opinion may recognize that very few men are actually faithful to their wives, and breaches of the fidelity norm by men may be viewed leniently, while unfaithful wives may be treated harshly. In this connection, I cannot help recalling what a knowledgeable Wakkaliga elder in Rampura, that is my field village, told me in 1948. What he said was that only one Wakkaliga elder in the village Rampura was faithful to his wife, and everyone admired him for this rather rare virtue. In other words, local opinion recognizes that some norms are more honored in the breach than in the observance. Again, in a stratified society, the fidelity norm may be regarded as more binding in some strata than in others. While values and norms varied from group to group, the locally dominant caste or other ethnic group provided a model for emulation for the non-dominants. But this operated in a circuitous way, not directly. Since the dominant caste were wealthy, powerful, and enjoyed high status, lower groups were not permitted to take over their customs, manners and lifestyles. The classic case is in Bihar, where only the dominant caste could have their mustaches turned up, and the scheduled caste and others had to have their mustache turned down. And if the scheduled caste had the temerity to turn it up, you see, then they would be beaten up and worse would follow. Any attempt on the part of the non-dominants to emulate the dominants invited punishment. But over a long period of time, some of the customs and manners of the dominants gradually percolated to the others. Incidentally, since the 1950s, this is an important change, the power of the dominants to enforce their will on the others has been eroded due to legislation, education, improved communications, and other modern factors. However, the dominants were not always Hindus. Jains, Sikhs, Christians, and Muslims enjoyed dominance in particular parts of India at different periods of time, and their culture influenced the culture of the area in which they were dominant. Some groups were particularly susceptible to the influence of the dominants. Thus, some Kayastha groups in parts of North India were influenced strongly by the local Muslim aristocracy. And in South India, the culture of the omnivorous martial cooks was influenced by the puritanical, vegetarian and non-martial Lingayat rulers. This is in the between 17th and 19th centuries. During colonial rule, however, the better off cooks were influenced by the culture of the British coffee planters in Coorg. In considering the values, norms and behavior of people in a country such as India, one cannot ignore the influence of the scriptures and the epics. It is possible that the influence of some scriptures such as the Manudharma Shastra on the conduct of Hindus has been greatly exaggerated, especially by reformers, but that is no reason for ignoring the influence of the sacred books. The only point is that such influence varies from region to region and group to group, and therefore difficult to generalize. In this connection, the proximity or otherwise of a great temple, monastery, pilgrimage center, or the capital of the kingdom radically affected the behavior of the people. For instance, given the lack of roads in pre-British India, people living even 25 miles from the capital of a Hindu king might be guided entirely by the norms of their caste or tribe, unless a great temple or monastery was located close by. At the same time, the popularity of the epics and the institution and of institutions such as Harikatha helped to spread certain values, norms, ideas and beliefs of all India Hinduism among people living in different parts of the country, including remote areas. Now, the two points which I have just made run counter to each other, but the interplay of contrary forces must be accepted as a basic characteristic of the field of our study. Contrary to popular belief that Indian society is rigid and immutable, it has been subject to continuous change. This is one of the results of recent sociological work. The fluidity which characterized the pre-British political system, particularly at the lower levels, was a source of dynamism in the sense that dominant castes often acquired political power at the local levels and sought to legitimize power by claiming to be Kshatriyas, employing genealogies to provide them with lineages which would be regarded as noble, and through Sanskritizing their ritual, custom and lifestyle. This in turn gave rise to local caste systems which differed in some ways from similar systems elsewhere. While caste has been studied in some depth, the Bhakti movement, which surfaced in almost all parts of the country, though at different times, and which was anti-caste, anti-Brahmin, anti-male patriarchy and anti-ritual, has not been studied in sufficient depth or seriousness by sociologists and anthropologists. What was the effect of the Bhakti movement on the caste system and on the ideology of gender relations? Has the Bhakti movement facilitated the acceptance of human equality? Considering that the Bhakti movement goes back to the 7th century AD, even if we ignore the Jain Buddhist protest movements of the 6th century BC, does protest against caste and gender inequalities form a main strand of Indian culture? This is an important question, and it has to be answered on the basis of serious research. The establishment of British rule in shutting the doors to group mobility through the well-known route of capturing political power at local levels, and the picture of Indian society as barbarous, hidebound, divided, and characterized by untouchability, sati, the inhuman treatment of widows, etc., painted by the British administrators and evangelizing missionaries, was accepted by Indian reformers early in the 19th century. This picture continues to persist, though recent sociological research has pointed out serious shortcomings in it. Changes in values and norms are frequently discussed at the individual level and without reference to the wider society of which individuals are members and the forces operating in the wider society. In this brief talk, however, some of the changes in the wider society are emphasized as they are essential to understanding changes in values and attitudes in India today. In section 2, I shall describe briefly a few major changes that were initiated during the early years of independence, and they in turn are responsible for some changes in values and attitudes of individuals. Soon after independence, the new rulers set themselves the task of producing a constitution committed to bringing about a change from a caste and feudal society to a casteless and classless society through the means of parliamentary democracy based on adult franchise. This was a revolutionary decision, in particular the introduction of adult franchise, considering the fact that only 16.6% of the population was then literate, and that over 80% of the people lived in villages which lacked roads and were isolated, particularly during the rainy season. Unlike other known revolutions in history, the Indian one was slow to pick up, was by and large non-violent till the early 70s, when it turned increasingly violent. Violence of all sorts is now widespread and in some parts of the country endemic. The elite which came to power with independence wanted the constitution to bring about fundamental changes in Indian economy, culture and society. The constitution provided not only a charter for ushering in a revolution, but the instruments for achieving it. As already mentioned, adult franchise was the principal means for bringing about the revolution, while other measures such as the outlawing of untouchability and its practice in any form declared an offence. The reservation of seats in legislatures for the SCs and STs and jobs in the government were also important. It must be mentioned, however, that these were intended as temporary measures in order to enable the SCs and STs to catch up with the forward sections of the society. Provision was also made for the states to take steps to advance the interests of the socially and educationally backward classes. The states were asked to prepare lists of such classes on the basis of objective criteria. Caste was chosen as a major criterion by several states on the basis of the level of education of its members and their representation in government services as compared with the average levels for all the castes in the state. Thank you. Just a second. States have been active since the 1920s in the promotion of the welfare of the OBCs, that's the socially and the educationally backward classes, and this has resulted in the latter making substantial gains. But states such as West Bengal and Orissa have not even prepared lists of the OBCs. The Mandal Commission, established by the Janata government in 1978 to suggest suitable measures for increasing the access of the OBCs all over India to education and employment in the government, recommended, among other things, the reservation of 27% of government jobs both at the center and the state for the OBCs. In August 1990, as everybody knows, Mr. V.P. Singh, then Prime Minister, decided to implement the Mandal Commission's recommendations regarding job reservation. This led to violent protests from college students all over the country, particularly in North India, and many of them committed suicide by setting fire to themselves. There were writ petitions against the government's decision in the Supreme Court. In a recent judgment, November 1992, however, the Supreme Court has upheld the government's decision to reserve 27% of government jobs at the center and in the states for the other backward classes, but they have also imposed a few new conditions. It's indeed impressive that India has been able to practice democracy since 1947, except during the emergency years 1975-77. The task of holding periodical elections for electorates running into a few hundred millions is indeed a Himalayan one. And what should be surprising is not that the elections are marred here and there by violence, booth capturing and rigging, but that the bulk of the people in this vast, poverty-stricken, backward and hierarchized country should not only practice democracy, but make attempts to deepen, extend and cleanse it. Democracy enables every tension in this to surface, and with increasing numbers of hereditary groups competing to obtain access to resources, which are getting scarcer, government is continually under such pressure that its survival occasionally appears precarious. But even such a situation is better than that under totalitarian regimes, where everything appears smooth on the surface, but only to collapse suddenly and irrevocably. Further, democracy is also an invaluable information system in a large, diversified and poor country like India. Democracy is a necessity for India, and it's likely that India's survival as a single entity is due to its adherence to democracy on the whole. Contrast in this connection the sudden collapse of countries to the north and west. India's success with democracy is far more relevant for the developing countries than its success in the UK or US. Another achievement is the manner in which India has increased its food production from about 52 million tons at the turn of independence to over 170 million tons today. Of course, production must continue to increase if the growing population has to be kept fed, let alone a surplus created for export. It is also remarkable that India has not had a famine after independence, whereas China has had disastrous famines during the years of the Cultural Revolution, 1954-56, when millions of people died, estimates varying between 16 to 30 millions. As a result of economic development since independence, the proportion of population below poverty line has come down to about one-third. But the country is far from abolishing poverty and from assuring the poorest that their basic needs will be met. At the last census, 1991, over a quarter of the people lived in urban areas, and the proportion of urban dwellers is expected to increase sharply by 2080. Substantial improvement has occurred in the position of women, but it is as yet confined largely to urban middle class women. However, women's movements have gained strength in the last three decades, and they are aimed at combating specific evils such as dowry and sati, and in achieving eventually gender equality. No discussion of changing values can avoid referring to pervasive corruption and violence in political and social life. Corruption has grown phenomenally during the last 30 years, and no area of life is free from it. Over the years, corruption has come to be accepted as a fact of life, and it is widely known that the citizen has to pay officials and politicians for permits, licenses and other favors. Government officials have to pay bribes, for instance, to be transferred out of place or to stay where they are. Transfers appear to be a major source of income
for the higher officials and their bosses, the ministers. This means that transferable officials must collect enough money in the course of their official work to be able to get or avoid a transfer. The net result is that the citizen is compelled to pay a bribe for anything he wants from the government. Corruption has penetrated so deep that a former chief minister of Karnataka once remarked that only a powerful social movement could put an end to it. Myths about the pervasiveness of corruption, I'm not talking about the fact of corruption, but myths about the corruption among the people and the size of the sums received by politicians are widespread, all increasing the demoralization of the people. There has been a tremendous increase in all kinds of violence, organized violence against the state, intergroup violence, intrafamilial violence, and an increase in the general climate of violence. And finally, as in the case of corruption, a tacit acceptance of violence and a growing insensitivity to murder, bloodshed, gang wars, and rape. Some of the violence is directly related to the politico-economic system if it does not stem out of it, as for instance in booth capturing. Since the acquisition of political power opens the doors to wealth, influence and status, all sorts of people, including smugglers, black marketeers and mafia dons, want to become MLAs and MPs. Political scientists and journalists have written at length about the criminalization of politics in recent years, but nothing has been done so far to tackle it. The other phenomenon, that once people get elected to power, they flout rules, regulations and even laws to feather their nests and to protect their relatives and cronies, is only too frequent. It is strange that politicians who flout rules and laws rarely suffer any punishment except being out of power for a while, after which they bounce back into public life. People discover new virtues in them, contrasting them with those who are in power at the moment. Another prime source of continued violence and frustration is the excessive concentration of power in the center. As compared with the constituent states, such concentration has been compounded by the creation of a planning commission, which has been a powerful arm of the center, allocating resources to the states and also in monitoring the implementation of the projects it funds. It is not unlikely that Punjab would not have experienced the kind of violence and alienation which it has if the states had enjoyed greater powers vis-à-vis the center. The Sarkaria Commission, which was appointed during Mrs. Gandhi's second term in office to examine the question of giving more powers to the states, submitted its reports a few years ago, but there has been no move to implement its recommendations. One reason may be that the center is so busy in what may be described as firefighting operations that it finds no time for long-term nation-building tasks such as reordering center-state relations and the creation of smaller states. I do not wish to discuss in detail the phenomenal increase in violence, particularly intergroup violence, since independence, but would merely like to point out that the abolition of untouchability, punishing its practice in any form, the reservation of seats in legislatures and jobs in government, and other concessions for the SCs and STs have angered large numbers of others, in particular the rural dominant castes. Clashes between the dominant castes and SCs are frequent and bloody and likely to increase with the SCs becoming more assertive of their rights. One of the side effects of increasing nationalism is, paradoxically, a heightened awareness of all lower level identities such as caste, region, religion, class and region. This has become accentuated in the context of economic development, one of the effects of which, at least in the short run, is to sharpen inequalities between the rich and the poor and between regions. In urban areas, which are invariably multi-ethnic, economic conflict between groups might assume the form of a struggle between the sons of the soil and outsiders, even if the former, that is the sons of the soil, are only earlier immigrants. The Shiv Sena provides a classic example of it. This kind of situation is often exacerbated by politicians, businessmen and the film industry, who may use such conflict to further their own ends. The presence of large numbers of unemployed, low-skilled, uneducated youth provides the requisite muscle power to fight the battles of the politicians and businessmen. No account of intergroup violence can afford to ignore clashes between members professing different faiths, which have become distressingly frequent in recent years. The causes are many and tangled, but an important factor has been the rise in the post-war world of religious fundamentalism everywhere, and in particular in West Asia. In the South Asian region, relations between Hindus and Muslims came under increasing tremendous strain during the closing years of British rule, and the departure of the British was marked by the partition of India into Pakistan and India, and by the most violent carnage in the region's history, in which nearly 500,000 people were massacred. However, independent India opted for a secular democratic constitution which guaranteed protection to the culture, language and religion of the minorities, while Pakistan declared itself an Islamic republic. But in the last few years, India's secularism, as everybody knows, has come under severe strain. The BJP and its allied organizations like the RSS, Vishwa Hindu Parishad and Bajrang Dal, charging the ruling Congress party with practicing pseudo-secularism and minoritism to the detriment of the interests of the Hindus, who constitute 80% of the population. The recent destruction of the Bari Masjid by the followers of the VHP and allied organizations in order to erect a temple to Rama in its place was followed by violent riots all over the country, in which over 1,100 people died, and it was greatly exacerbated relations between Hindus and Muslims. The destruction of Hindu and Jain temples and churches in Pakistan and Hindu temples in Bangladesh in retaliation to the destruction of the Masjid have added fuel to the fire. The net result is that India's political system and social order are facing a very severe crisis. With the rapid spread of dowry among the people, cutting across not only caste, but sect, religion, class and region, intrafamilial violence has increased enormously. Harsh economic calculations enter into all traditional marriages, the main aim being to become rich quickly at the expense of the bride's family, and huge sums of cash, gold and consumer durables being extracted by the groom's family. The size of the dowry has become an indication of the status of the groom's family. Greed and crass materialism mark marriage negotiations, and dowry demands often pursue the wretched wife even after she has given birth to one or two children. Many women chooses to escape torture and humiliation from her affiance by committing suicide by the horrible method of dousing her sari with kerosene and setting fire to herself. It has almost become a cultural mode of committing suicide, like in the South Seas, where you commit suicide by climbing up the tallest coconut tree and falling down it. One cannot fail to mention the part played by the media, the films and the TV, in particular, in fomenting a climate of violence. Violence, sex and drugs seem to be the staple of films, both foreign and Indian. And the TV brings all this into the living room. With the coming in of cable television and Star TV, the Indian living room has become literally open to the entire world. Since independence, there has been a visible improvement in the standards of large numbers of people who eat better, dress better, invest sizable portions of their income in the education of their children, live in better housing, spend sizable sums in buying such consumer durables as refrigerators, TV sets, washing machines, mixies, two-wheelers, cars and VCPs. The market for these commodities comprise the middle classes and the top 10% of the population, both together amounting to 340 million in 1987 88. I'm a bit suspicious about this figure. I've taken it from the National Council for Applied Economic Research, but I think the figure should be lower, but I think this should be looked into. It's a huge and growing market, and it's no wonder that multinationals appear to be keen to enter it. It may be noted that buyers of consumer durables are not confined to urban areas. The better off in rural areas are also going in for them. It's not unlikely that the status component in the buying of consumer durables is even higher in villages than in the cities, as those who own these durables are a very small proportion of the local population, and the possession of durables being a clear marker of social distance between the haves and the have-nots. Improvements in living standards is usually, if not invariably, followed by an attempt on the part of the upwardly mobile individual to improve the social standing of his family, if not of his larger kin group. A key element in upward mobility is education, for without it, good jobs will not be available, living standards cannot be improved, good marriages cannot be contracted, and access to other elements of high status denied. But there is severe competition for obtaining admission to good schools, which means by and large, from the point of view of parents, English medium schools. Such preference has also spread to rural areas in parts of the country. The tremendous demand for admission to good English medium schools has led to the latter charging enormous fees, and in addition to the payment of sizable amounts of money as admission fees. The government has no control over private schools in such matters. This practice is confined at present in some parts of the country, but all over India, urban parents experience acute anxiety over the admission of their children to what they consider to be good schools. Parental anxiety reaches its apogee, however, at the time of their offspring seeking admission to colleges, in particular medical, engineering, technical and other professional colleges. The question of admission is further complicated by reserving a proportion of seats to the weaker sections of the society. Such reservation is probably the highest in Karnataka, where not more than 30% of the seats are allotted on the basis of merit as measured by marks obtained in the qualifying examinations and in the examination and the entrance test. The net result is that a large number of good students from forward castes are rejected, while those getting lower marks but hailing from the weaker sections obtain admission. Also, rich and ambitious parents of ordinary students would like the latter to be admitted to professional courses of studies. There is a standing monument to it across the road. There is thus a considerable demand for starting new professional colleges. This situation has given rise to the institution of capitation fees, by which private colleges collect enormous sums of money for admission of students. Capitation fee colleges are Karnataka's contribution to the spread of higher education in India. And such colleges are cosmopolitan in the sense that they attract rich students from all over the country and even abroad. There is currently a move to ban capitation fee colleges, but I think that unless the causes which give rise to such institutions are addressed, it will not be possible to put an end to them. Politicians controlling vote banks from the dominant castes, the SCs, STs and the minorities, see not only much money in starting professional colleges, but a potent means of consolidating and even extending their vote banks. By now it is well known that many of those who obtain admission have neither the ability nor the interest to pursue exacting courses of professional study, even when the institutions are well equipped and have competent teachers, which is not always the case. The question then arises, why do so many parents want to admit their offspring to such tough and demanding courses of study? The obvious answer that the possession of professional degrees provide the key to economic security is not true. For newspapers recently, that is in 1992, reported that in Karnataka alone there were 18,000 engineering graduates who were unemployed, and there were also dozens of unemployed doctors. But society continues to place a high value on professional education, and the doctor or engineer's son may fetch a big dowry, which not only improves the family's finances but its social standing. In some parts of the country, however, there is a caste component in the demand for professional education. The earlier entrants to professional education were from the higher castes, and their success and prosperity stimulated large numbers of from the backward classes to emulate them. The reservation of seats in educational institutions on a caste basis was practiced in parts of South India well before the adoption in the Constitution of India, new Constitution of India. It is surprising that parents, I think of educated parents, do not seem to pay any attention to the talents and inclinations of their children in choosing careers. The main motive in choosing a professional career for a son or daughter seems to be to boost the latter's image and their own standing among their relatives, friends, and neighbors. The idea that a person should pursue a career which should allow him to, which should allow his innate talents to develop, so that work not only gives an income but a sense of satisfaction, does not seem to be accepted even among the middle classes. A surer and more expensive way of producing educated misfits cannot be imagined. The Government of India had a constitutional obligation to make education compulsory for all children in the age group of 5 to 14 within a period of 10 years from 1951. But this has not been met even after 45 years of independence. Further, the national literacy rate is 52.11%. But there are regions where literacy, particularly female literacy, is abysmally low. However, paradoxical as it may seem, higher education continues to be highly subsidized, and there is the proud boast that India is the third largest producer of scientific and technological specialists in the world. The IITs enjoy great prestige as institutions and are highly subsidized by the government. Admission to them is eagerly sought after and highly competitive, but how many of those who graduate from them stay in India? Indeed, the question needs to be asked, how many of those who benefit from studying in the elite institutions of higher education in India seek careers in the country? Our most successful exports are our best and brightest men and women. In contrast to Indians who went abroad in the 40s and even the early 50s for higher studies, those who go abroad nowadays do not seem to want to return to seek careers in India. Excited parents are heard saying, "My son or daughter does not want to come back. What is there to come back to?" And they are right. Many of our universities and other centers of higher learning have become cockpits for caste, regional, and linguistic conflicts and intrigue, and both teaching and research being in a deplorable condition. Appointments are frequently made on grounds other than merit. In fact, merit has become a dirty word in the lexicon of the advocates of caste quotas and the progressives. Until recently, some concern was expressed about brain drain from India to the developed countries and the need to reverse the flow. But such concern seems to have evaporated quietly, and the expatriates have become NRIs, whose dollars seem to be more important to the country than their skills, qualifications, and experience. The irony of this situation seems to be lost on everyone. Greenbacks have become more welcome than grey cells. The foreign bug has bitten not only the young, but older people. Middle-aged Indian women now travel to the US or UK to oversee the pregnancies of their daughters, reversing the traditional custom of pregnant daughters going to their natal homes for confinement. Middle-aged women love to talk to their relatives and friends about their stay abroad, the air-conditioned homes and cars, the gadgetry, the glories of the American supermarket, and the conveniences and wealth their offspring command in America. Back home, the middle-class family has shrunk. Elderly parents living by themselves and receiving dollar checks from their offspring in America, UK and the Gulf States. No, America and UK and Gulf States have become emotionally close to middle class Indians. Very soon, it will not be untrue to define the urban middle class family as one which has at least one person living and earning abroad. I shall now return to the phenomenon of consumerism, indeed galloping consumerism, for no account of changing values can be complete without reference to it. This is a fairly recent phenomenon, but it's making up for lost time by the speed with which it is spreading. Consumerism is heavily dependent on advertising, and the advertising business is not only booming, but it attracts many talented people. Indian newspapers and journals nowadays regularly bring out lush supplements with multicolored illustrations on expensive glossy paper, but with hardly any reading matter. Looking at them, one wonders whether India is indeed a poor country. Advertisements figure on the TV with glamorous film, sports and athletic stars urging the viewer to buy this or that variety of TV set, refrigerator, washing machine, shaving soap, mouthwash, toothpaste, textiles, shoes and so on. It is safe to assume that so far as TV is concerned, India is only witnessing the beginning of its exposure. Star TV and cable TV have already made considerable inroads into Indian homes. TV watching has become an addiction with large numbers of people, and I learned that even in a remote small temple town like Melkote, over 200 houses have Star TV and CNN connections. It is alleged that priests hurry through their worship in the temples to go home and watch their favorite TV programs. A distinct teenage culture is emerging, or has already emerged as a result of the emergence of a sizable middle class whose youth offer a tempting market for a variety of goods which can be advertised in the newspapers and on the TV. These teenagers are recognizable by their distinctive dress, hairstyle, lingo, habits and lifestyle. Their heroes and heroines are usually sportsmen, athletes, film stars, rock musicians and models. The better off among them visit pubs, Bangalore being a trendsetter, go disco dancing and smoke pot. They are more subject to peer group pressure than to parental pressure. Recently, a journalist acquaintance of mine told me that his 10-year-old son tells him which brand of clothes, shoes, socks and school bag he wants. All of them are expensive brands advertised on the TV. A few weeks ago, a local journalist phoned me to ask me whether he could interview me on the influence of MTV on teenagers. I asked him, what on earth is MTV? I did not know then that so many teenagers in Bangalore were already hooked on to the MTV. MTV. Elders know very little about the new emerging teenage culture. I want to emphasize this. It's a new and unknown culture. Why I study the new savages, the next generation. An inevitable consequence of growing consumerism is the pressure to buy goods which are not needed. Housewives and teenagers are likely to feel its pressure even more than elderly people. Higher purchase schemes, cheat funds, the organization of periodic sales by big firms and the use of credit cards are an inevitable consequence of consumerism. Having a lot of goods enhances one's status, and one is judged by what one has and not by what one is. When the rich and the middle classes go in for consumerism, the gulf between them and the poor will widen even further. Since the richest villages are also victims of consumerism, the rich-poor divide will sharpen in rural areas also. Given the tensions which already exist, caste, region, language, region, and low status, consumerism might prove to be the last straw on the backs of the poor. Given an opportunity, the poor might do in Indian cities what the American blacks did some years ago in Watts and New York. The situations are not dissimilar. A major change that has occurred with independence and adult franchise is the emergence of political power as more or less supreme. More or less the supreme value for very large numbers of people.
translating this into traditional terms, if such translation is possible, it is as though Artha, the politico-economic realm, has become sovereign, cutting itself loose from Dharma, the moral realm. Moksha, the ultimate value, is far too distant to be able to influence people directly. But its indirect influence may be seen in such activities of the elderly as performing daily puja and meditation at home, visiting temples and pilgrimage centers, performing bhajans, reading religious literature, and leading a lifestyle characterized by attention to things spiritual and indifference to things material. They are a minority, but they are there. Even within the realm of Artha, this is coming back to Artha, power has emerged as superior to wealth, for power can confer wealth and much else besides. The ease and swiftness with which politicians become extremely wealthy is a very familiar phenomenon. But it's also true that businessmen who are very wealthy can use their wealth to manipulate governmental decisions in their favor. In the process, the politician and the administrator also benefit, the only ones to lose being the people. That wealth is also used to atone for one's sins and increase one's stock of merit by doing works of charity and controlling, contributing funds to temples, mosques and churches is also a fact of life. The idea has not lost its hold, indeed, if anything, the contrary. But it is important to note that power does not only have instrumental value, but it is also endowed with glamour. The trappings and perquisites of power, uniformed sentries, resplendently dressed servants, government cars, telephones, PAs, and the hundreds of favor seekers who throng the compounds of ministers and their obsequiousness all serve to proclaim the magic of power. No wonder so many people want it. Finally, power has emerged as the legitimizer of all achievement, and indeed of all activity, especially public activity. Minister are asked to open, inaugurate, release, preside, chair and grace all kinds of functions. Sometimes half the cabinet attends a function, and those ministers who do not oblige the organizers are dubbed arrogant. How much of his time a minister spends in attending to his ministry's affairs and in attending to the problems of his constituents, and how much on ceremonial and public functions, public relations exercises, is a matter deserving serious examination. A recent and significant development is the coming together of the politician and the renouncer, or the man in ochre robes. The politician is indeed versatile. At one end, he moves from the company of criminals of all kinds at one end to that of godmen and sannyasis at the other. Here, a distinction needs to be made between different kinds of renouncers who engage themselves in welfare activities, and renouncers who are reputed to possess power to effect cures and perform miracles, and finally, pure contemplatives like Sri Ramakrishna and Ramana Maharshi. Those who are engaged in welfare activities, such as starting schools, colleges, hostels, orphanages, hospitals, and old people's homes, need to cultivate politicians to obtain grants of land and money, and various kinds of permits and even favors. Politicians know that it is good for their image to be seen close to renouncers, and there is always the hope that at some point closeness might yield votes. Godmen command large followings, and their support is not only politically beneficial, but provides a shield against the insecurities of the high-risk profession of politics. Finally, the reclusive renouncer is contacted only rarely for his blessings. It is in the Indian tradition that the temporal realm acknowledges, though only rarely, the supremacy of the spiritual. An inevitable result of enhanced opportunities for a large number of people and the prevalence of acute competition for obtaining access to resources such as education, employment, and a comfortable standard of living is the spread of stress and stress-related ailments among the people.
high blood pressure, nervous tension, hyperacidity and insomnia are becoming indicators of middle and upper caste status. When neglected, they may lead to inefficiency in work, inability to cope with the many demands made on one, and in extreme cases, nervous breakdown. Not only are there not enough psychiatrists to cope with these maladies, the available psychiatrists are a handful, but the culture of going to psychiatrists and counselors is not there. Under these circumstances, prayer and meditation and visits to temples and pilgrimage centers offer some relief to people, though rationalists may scoff at such practices. People in all walks of life consult astrologers, though it is likely that the middle and upper classes nowadays resort to them more than the others as their lives are coming under increasing stress. It is not that the lives of the poor are stress-free, but they also have their temples, oracles, amulets, exorcists and holy men. Incidentally, consulting astrologers is not peculiar to Indians or Asians for that matter. It is prevalent in the West too. The Reagans consulted 3 astrologers. Princess Diana has an astrologer, and we do not know about the other VIPs in the West who consult astrologers. While consulting astrologers is widespread in India, there is a reluctance to acknowledge the fact, particularly among the educated. Intellectuals do not hesitate to pose coroner on astrology, though it is not certain that they do not consult astrologers when they themselves are in trouble. To recapitulate, in discussing changing values in India today, my approach has been that of an empirically minded sociologist. But I am also a citizen, an individual with my own preferences, values if you like. On the institutional side, I think that people's movements are essential to set right the many ills that infest the body as social, of which the body politic is a vital part. People's movements are indispensable to lessen corruption in Indian public life, to see that development plans do not destroy the environment, to ensure gender equality, to promote decentralization of power, and to combat growing consumerism. People's movements are needed particularly to teach elected representatives that real power in a democracy rests with the people, and that errant, corrupt or perverse governments will not be tolerated. The tendency to autocracy is so deep at the state and lower levels that periodical elections are not enough to curb autocracy. People's movements might provide the necessary curb, but they need time to be built up, given the fact that the electorate is poor, uneducated, and local leaders are bribable. Perhaps institutions such as recall may be necessary to make leaders more responsive to public opinion. There is also a need for cutting down on the role of government and to encourage people to develop their own initiatives. To this end, voluntary organizations need to be encouraged, particularly in the execution and monitoring of development and welfare work. On the individual plane, there is a need to spread the message that happiness consists not in the senseless accumulation of goods which one can do without, but in doing work which not only gives money but satisfaction. It is also necessary to realize that those who are gifted have an obligation to use their gifts which they have inherited, and they are not responsible for what they have inherited, and which a favorable environment in early years developed for the good of society, for the benefit of those who are weaker, and not for self-aggrandizement and self-glorification. Thank you very much.
I think what is happening now has to be put an end to, you see. Because I don't know the latest figures, how many of them stay back, you see. In fact, I remember about even 12, 13 years ago, I had to spend a couple of days with a young Gujarati doctor from Baroda. He is now, I'm told, he's a thoracic surgeon. He's in his early 40s. He's making about $500,000 a year, you see. And he told me, I mean, without any kind of, criticism of what is happening, that in the 70s, out of a batch of 93 students in the medical college in Baroda, only 3 students or so stayed back. 90 of them went abroad, you see. I mean, I think this has to be stopped. As to how it can be done, whether it's IIT or
medical or technology, other technical, technical or technological institutions. I think it should be done, you know, very carefully by groups of people who have experience of these institutions and so on. You see. But I think they should be that should stop. If a very dogmatic answer, I think creative individuals will do it. Just as poets, artists, and scientists arise in a society, a reformer is no less creative. You see, I mean. What did Gandhi do, you see? I mean, look at the scene when Gandhi arrived in India in 1917 and how he transformed it in the course of four decades, you see. I think you leave it to the creative person who feels in his bones the agony of the society and feels it so, you know, so intensely that he says, I must do something. And he is a creative person. He draws on tradition or reinterpreted tradition. And he also has the current needs and aspirations of the society in mind. And there is a creative mix of all this, and there is a new interpretation. Raja Ramon Rai,
There are several people asking questions, but...
You see, one of the things, as I see it, I may be wrong, in traditional India, you know, my own view of the Varna system is different. The Brahmin may be Purohita, in the sense he was walking ahead of the king, but he was not superior to the king. He was Purohita, means walking ahead, you see. Power-wise, the king was the person who called the shots. But the king was on a lower level in relation to the renouncer. I mean, you know, the man who really gave up the world to contemplate on divinity, and his detachment enabled him to look at world's affairs in a way different from that of ordinary mortals. But what I fear, where I fear, I didn't say it, I'm not sure of it, but one of the most dangerous things that is happening, according to me, is the co-option of the renouncer into the political system. And I think in the process, without the knowledge, I'm being very impertinent considering issue on which I am speaking, maybe I am wrong, I hope I am wrong. Even the renouncer is not aware that he is being corrupted, you see, by contact with the, you know, the coming in of the Qadi and the ochre robe is not for the good of the ochre robe, you see. That's how I feel.
You wanted to ask?
I just wanted to avoid getting bogged down in values and norms. In fact, I have a long footnote on values and so on after I, you know, first presented the paper. Because one of my major task here was to avoid getting into a Brahminical discussion of values, norms, and other ideas in order to get on with what is happening on the ground. But if the point you are making is that some of these values have been only at the verbal level, existed at the verbal level without actually influencing the actual behavior of the people, I think for particular values you can can discuss them in relation to sections of the society. I mean, that is a matter for empirical discussion, you see. But I think by and large the distinction I make between values at one level and norms at the other level and actual behavior, and even in norms, between ideal norms and statistical norms, I think, by and large, I think they are necessary as scaffolding for a discussion such as this, you see. But empirically, you know, we will have to discuss whether any particular idea has been actually effective, you see.
Yes, please.
I think it should start, you know, it should start at the top in one sense, but, you know, I think the top needs to be transformed. I also note that Bark has protested, you see. Not only the Science Congress, but Bark also has protested. I think that is very necessary, you see. I think I would regard it as a creative conflict, you see. But I think reforms, you can't confine it to Raja Ramon Rai. Jyotirao Phule was a very effective reformer, you see. And, you know, he was not top. He was a Mali by profession. He started a school for scheduled castes and so on. So I think it should come at every level, you see. It's such a diverse, fragmented, sectionalized, hierarchized society, such as I would say it should be value, you know, a struggle at
in every part of the country at every level, you see. Otherwise, you know, it won't filter down to the people at large. You see.
One last question from Dr. Avinayan. I'm sure there are many people wanting to talk, but...
And I agree with you and I disagree with you. I think what has happened with the bhakti movement, you know, I mean, take the classic case of the Virashaiva movement. It was started by a renegade Brahmin. It was a tremendous protest movement in Karnataka. You know, it was really a revolution. But where it failed was, it failed to alter, I think I'm not a Marxist, but I would say the mode of production. As long as the mode of production at the village level was tied to the Jajmani system and the caste system, you know, any kind of protest movement which doesn't take note of the institutions will fail. So in that sense, what happens to these protest movements is, over a period of time, they become a caste or a system of caste, as with the Lingayats, you see. That way, the overall system protects itself against rebellious movement. You know, the only systems which existed outside were the Jains and the Buddhists. But even they, you know, in a sense, were part of the Hindu family, you could say. But where I differ from you is, I have long thought about it, you know, in fact, I want to write about it. I reject the conspiracy view of caste. You see, caste is too big a thing. From Varna, it was a kind of, you know, it was a kind of division of labor in the Vedic period, and according to the latest French Indologists like de Musil, you see, they show that it was clearly a matter of division of labor, and membership of a Varna was voluntary and not hereditary. But Varna system later on got tangled in some way with the concepts of pollution and purity and produced a number of jatis all over the country, you see. And this, I think, is not the conspiracy of the Brahmins. Because the reason why I say this is, I think the caste system is so deep-rooted, so fundamental. It's like the Himalayas, you see. It's like cancer. I mean, Himalayas are the cancer. It is there and it absorbs everything. Once, you know, it started and developed at some point of time, it gets its own autonomous existence and it gets an ability to absorb counter forces, which is really, I mean, if you look at it purely structurally, it's a marvelous kind of cancer which you see. And I'm occasionally, you know, when I see the evils of the caste system, but I also contemplate it as a pure theoretical sociologist. I wonder at this system, its ability to survive. I mean, go back to the Vedas, and it's there and it's developed and it controls everything, you see. I don't know if I'm making myself, you know, but I have to be honest with you. I look at it sometimes as a structure, as you know, swallowing everything that is opposed to it, you see. I mean, that is, you know, in a sense, its ability. I think some diseases have this ability.
I've just heard... We have just heard a very panoramic exposition of what has been going on in India in the last few years. I see in it not only the work of a dispassionate social scientist, but also the anguish of a very sensitive and a compassionate soul. Thank you very much, Professor Srinivas, for talking to us.
Thank you.